him abruptly.
"I couldn't say," he said. "I was a three-year-old beggar child when I set fire to Varsha, trying to stay warm on the street one winter's night. They didn't bother to hunt up my family before they packed me off to the capital." He spoke indifferently, as if he didn't mind it, being unmoored from all the world. "Don't make mournful faces at me," he added. "That was a century and a half ago, and five kings have breathed their last since then. Six kings," he amended. "Come here and help me find a crack to open." It was full dark by then, and no way of finding any crack except by touch. I put my hand on the wall and almost jerked it back again. The stone murmured so strangely under my fingers, a chorus of deep voices. I looked closer. We had turned up more than bare rock and earth. There were broken pieces of carved blocks jutting from the dirt, the bones of the old lost tower. Ancient words were carved upon them in places, faint and nearly worn away, but still there, to be felt, even if not seen. I took my hands away and rubbed them against each other. My fingers felt dusty, dry. "They're long gone," Sarkhan said, but the echoes lingered. The wood had thrown down that last tower. The wood had devoured and scattered all those people. Maybe it had happened like this for them too. Maybe they'd been turned and twisted into weapons against one another, until all of them were dead and the roots of the wood could quietly creep over their bodies. I put my hands back on the stone. Sarkhan had found a narrow crack in the wall, barely wide enough for fingertips. We took hold of it on opposite sides and pulled together. "Fall, Medesh," I said, as he made a spell of opening, and between us the crack widened with a sound like plates breaking on a stone floor. A crumbling waterfall of pebbles came pouring out. The soldiers dug out the loose stones with their helmets and their gauntleted hands while we pulled the crack still wider. When we were done, the tunnel was just big enough for a man in armor to get through if he stooped. Inside, the faint gleams of silvery blue letters shone here and there out of the dark. I scurried through the mouse hole of it as quickly as I could, trying not to look at them. The soldiers began working in the trench behind us, while we walked all the long curve of the wall to the southern end to make the second opening. By the time we finished the second tunnel, Marek's men had begun to try the outer wall. Not very seriously yet. They were lobbing over burning rags soaked in lamp oil, small thorny bits of iron with spikes pointing in every direction. But that almost made the Baron soldiers happier. They stopped watching me and Sarkhan like we were poisonous snakes and began comfortably bawling out orders and making siege preparations, work they all plainly knew well. There wasn't a place for us among them. We were only in their way. I didn't try to speak to any of them after all. I silently followed the dragon back to the tower. He shut the great doors behind us, the thump of the bar falling onto the iron braces, echoing against the marble. The entry and the great hall were unchanged, the unwelcoming narrow wooden benches standing against the walls, the hanging lamps above. Everything as stiff and formal as the first day I'd come wandering through here with my tray of food, so frightened and alone. Even the Baron preferred to sleep outside with his men in the warm weather. I could hear their voices outside through the arrow-slit windows, but only faintly, as if they came from far away. Some of the soldiers were singing a song together, a body song probably, but full of glad working rhythm. I couldn't make out the words. "We'll have a little quiet at least," Sarkhan said, turning from the doors towards me. He wiped a hand across his forehead, streaking a clean line through the fine layer of gray stone dust clinging to his skin. His hands were stained with green powder and iridescent traces of oil that shone in the lamplight. He looked down at them with a grimace of distaste, at the loose sleeves of his work shirt coming unrolled. For a moment, we might have been alone in the tower again. Just the two of us, with no armies waiting outside, no royal children hiding in the cellar, with the shadow of the wood falling across our door. I forgot I was trying to be angry at him. I wanted to go into his arms and press my face into his chest and breathe him in, smoke and ash and sweat, all together. I wanted to shut my eyes and have him put his arms around me. I wanted to rub handprints through his dust. "Sarkhan," I said. "They'll most likely attack at the first light of morning," he said too quickly, cutting me off before I could say anything more. His face was as closed up as the doors. He stepped back from me and gestured at the stairs. "The best thing you can do at the moment is get some sleep."
Chapter 27. What perfectly sensible advice. It sat in my stomach, an indigestible lump. I went down to the cellars to lie down with Kasha and the children, and curled up quietly, seething around it. Their small, even breaths came behind me. The sound should have been comforting. Instead, it just taunted me. "They're asleep, and you aren't." The cellar floor couldn't cool my fever skin. My body remembered the endless day. I'd woken up that morning on the other side of the mountains, and I still felt the echoes of hoofbeats on stone behind me, coming closer. The strain of my panicked breaths straggling against my ribs as I ran with Marisha in my arms. I had bruises where her heels had banged against the sides of my legs. I should have been spent. But magic was still alive and shivering in my belly, too much of it, with nowhere to go, as if I were an overripe tomato that wanted to burst its skin for relief, and there was an army outside our doors. I didn't think Solia had spent the evening preparing defenses and sleep spells. He'd fill our trenches with white fire and tell Marek where to point the cannon so they could kill the most men. He was a war wizard. He'd been at dozens of battles, and Marek had the entire army of Polnia behind him. 6,000 men to our 600. If we didn't stop them, if Marek came through the walls we'd built and smashed the doors, killed us all, and took the children. I threw off the covers and got up. Kasha's eyes opened just briefly to see me, and then closed again. I slipped away to sit by the ashes in the hearth, shivering. I couldn't stop thinking in circles about how easy it would be to lose, about the wood rolling dark and terrible over the valley. A green swallowing wave. I tried not to see it, but in my mind's eye, a heart tree rose up in the square in Dvernik, sprawling and monstrous as that terrible tree in Porosna, behind the borders of the wood, and everyone I loved was tangled beneath its grasping roots. I stood and fled from my own imagining up the stairs, in the great hall. The arrow-slit windows were dark. There wasn't even a snatch of song outside to drift in. All the soldiers were sleeping. I kept climbing, past the laboratory and the library, green and violet and blue lights still flickering behind their doors. But they were empty. There was no one there for me to shout at, no one to snap back at me and tell me I was being a fool. I went up another flight and stopped at the edge of the next landing, near the fringed end of the long carpet. A faint gleam showed from underneath a farthest door at the end of the hallway. I had never gone that way, towards Sarkhan's private bedroom. It had been an ogre's chamber once. The carpet was thick and dark, with a pattern woven into it with golden yellow thread. The pattern was all one line. It began in a tight spiral, like the curl of a lizard's tail. The golden line grew thicker as it unwound, and then went twisting back and forth along the length of the rug, almost like a pathway, leading into the shadows down the hallway. My feet sank deep in the soft wool. I followed the golden line as it broadened beneath my feet and took on a pattern like scales, faintly gleaming. I passed the guest chambers, two doors opposite one another, and beyond them, the hallway darkened around me. I was walking past a kind of pressure, a wind blowing against me. The pattern in the carpet was forming into clearer shapes. I walked over one great ivory clawed limb, over the sweep of pale golden wings, vein in dark brown. The wind grew colder, the walls disappeared, fading into part of the dark. The carpet widened until it filled all the hallway I could see and stretched away beyond. It didn't feel like wool anymore. I stood on warm lapping scales, soft as leather, rising and falling beneath my feet. The sound of breathing echoed back from the cavern walls out of sight. My heart wanted to hammer with instinctive terror. My feet wanted to turn and run. I shut my eyes instead. I knew the tower by now, how long the hallway should have been. I took three more steps along the scaled back, and then I turned and put out my hand, reaching for the door I knew was there. My fingers found a doorknob, warm metal beneath my fingers. I opened my eyes again, and I was back in the hallway, looking at the door. A few steps farther on, the hall and the carpet ended. The golden pattern turned back on itself, and the gleaming green eye looked up at me from a head filled with rows of silver teeth, waiting for anyone who didn't know where to turn. I opened the door. It swung silently. The room wasn't large. The bed was small and narrow, canopied and curtained in with red velvet. A single chair stood before the fireplace, beautifully carved, alone. A single book on the small table beside it, with a single cup of wine, half drunk. The fire was banked down to glowing coals, and the lamps were out. I went to the bed and drew aside the curtain. Sarkhan was sleeping, stretched across the bed, still in his breeches and his loose shirt. He'd only thrown off his coat. I stood holding the curtain. He blinked awake at me, unguarded for a moment, too startled to be indignant, as if he'd never imagined anyone could barge in on him. He looked so baffled, I didn't want to shout at him anymore. "How did you?" he said, pushing himself up on an elbow, indignation finally dawning, and I pushed him back down and kissed him. He made a noise of surprise against my mouth and gripped me by the arms, holding me off. "Listen, you impossible creature," he said. "I am a century and more older than..." "Oh, be quiet," I said impatiently. Of all the excuses he might have used. I scrambled up the tall side of the bed and climbed in on top of him, the thick feather bed yielding. I glared down. "Do you want me to go?" His hands tightened on my arms. He didn't look me in the face. For a moment he didn't speak. Then harshly he said, "No." And then he pulled me down to him instead. His mouth sweet and feverish hot and wonderful, obliterating. I didn't have to think anymore. The heart tree blazed up with a crackling roar and was gone. There was only the heat of his hands sliding over my chilled bare arms, making me shiver all over again. He had one arm around me, gripping tight. He caught at my waist and pulled up my loose, falling-off blouse. I ducked my head through, and my arms free of the sleeves, my hair spilling over my shoulders, and he groaned and buried his face into the tangled mess of it, kissing me through it. My throat, my shoulders, my breasts. I clung to him, breathless and happy, and full of uncomplicated, innocent terror. It hadn't occurred to me that he would. His tongue slid over my nipple and drew it into his mouth, and I flinched a little and clutched at his hair, probably painfully. He drew away, the sudden cold, a bright shock on my skin, and he said, "Agnieszka," low and deep, with an almost despairing note, as if he still wanted to shout at me and couldn't. He rolled us over in the bed and dumped me in the pillows beneath him. I gripped fistfuls of his shirt and pulled frantic. He sat up and threw it off over his head, and I threw my head back and stared at the canopy while he pushed up the maddening heap of my skirts. I felt desperately greedy, urgent for his hands. I'd tried not to remember that one shocking, perfect moment, the slide of his thumb between my legs, for so long. But oh, I remembered. He brushed his knuckles against me, and that sweet jolting went through me again. I shuddered all over, hugely, and I closed my thighs tight around his hand, instinctive. I wanted to tell him to hurry, to go slow, to do both at the same time. The curtain had fallen shut again. He was leaning over me, his eyes only a gleam in the dark closed room of the bed, and he was ferociously intent, watching my face. He could still rub his thumb against me, just a little. He stroked just once. A noise climbed the back of my throat, a sigh or a moan, and he bent down and kissed me like he wanted to devour it, to catch it in his own mouth. He moved his thumb again, and I stopped clenching shut. He gripped my thighs and moved them apart, lifted my leg around his waist. He was still watching me hungrily. "Yes," I said, urgently trying to move with him, but he kept stroking me with his fingers. "Sarkin." "Surely, it's not too much to ask a little patience," he said, his black eyes glittering. I glared at him, but then he stroked me again, gently, dipped his fingers into me. He drew a long line between my thighs again and again, circling at the top. He was asking me a question I didn't know the answer to, until I did. I clenched up suddenly, wrung out and wet against his hands. I fell back shaking against the pillows. I put my hands up into my snarled mess of hair and pressed them against my damp forehead, panting. "Oh," I said. "Oh." "There," he said, smugly pleased with himself, and I sat up and pushed him backwards the other way on the bed. I caught the waist of his breeches. He was still wearing his breeches, and said, "Hulvad." They melted into the air with a jerk, and I flung my skirts after them. He lay naked beneath me, long and lean, and suddenly narrow-eyed, his hands on my hips, the smirk fallen away from his face. I climbed onto him. "Sarkin," I said, holding the smoke and thunder of his name in my mouth like a prize, and slid onto him. His eyes shut tight, clenched. He looked almost in pain. My whole body felt wonderfully heavy, pleasure still going through me in widening ripples, a kind of tight ache. I liked the feeling of him deep in me. He was panting in long, ragged breaths. His thumbs were pressing tight on my hips. I held on to his shoulders and rocked against him. "Sarkin," I said again. I rolled it on my tongue, explored all the long, dark corners of it, parts hiding deep, and he groaned, helplessly, and surged up against me. I wrapped my legs around his waist, clinging, and he put an arm tight around me and bore me over and down into the bed. I lay curled snuggly against his side, 2 feet in a small bed, catching my breath. His hand was in my hair, and his face, staring up at the canopy, was oddly bewildered, as if he couldn't quite remember how all of this had happened. My arms and legs were full of sleep, heavy, as if it would have taken a winch to lift them. I rested against him, and finally asked, "Why did you take us?" His fingers were carding absently through my hair, straightening out tangles. They paused. After a moment, he sighed beneath my cheek. "You're bound to the valley. All of you. Born and bred here," he said. "It has a hold on you, but that's a channel of its own in turn, and I could use it to siphon away some of the wood's strength." He raised his hand and drew it flat over the air above our heads, a fine tracery springing up silver behind the sweep of his palm, a skeletal version of the painting in my room, a map of lines of magic running through the valley. They followed the long bright path of the spindle and all its small tributaries coming in from the mountains with gleaming stars for Alshanka and all our villages. The lines didn't surprise me somehow. It felt like something I'd always known was there, beneath the surface. The splash of the water bucket echoing up from the deep well in the village square in Dvernik. The murmur of the spindle running quick in summer. They were full of magic, of power, there to be drawn up. And so, he'd cut irrigation lines to pull more of it away before the wood could get hold of it. "But why did you need one of us?" I said, still puzzled. "You could have just..." I made a cupping gesture. "Not without being bound to the valley myself," he said, as if that was all the explanation in the world. I grew very still against him, confusion rising in me. "You needn't be alarmed," he added, dryly, misunderstanding dreadfully. "If we manage to survive the day, we'll find a way to untangle you from it." He drew his palm back over the silver lines, wiping them away again. We didn't speak again. I didn't know what to say. After a while, his breath evened out beneath my cheek. The heavy velvet hangings, deep dark, closed us in all around, as if we lay inside his walled heart. I didn't feel the hard grip of fear anymore, but I ached instead. A few tears were stinging in my eyes, hot and smarting, as if they were trying to wash out a splinter, but there weren't enough of them to do it. I almost wished I hadn't come upstairs. I hadn't really thought about after we stopped the wood and survived. It seemed absurd to think about after something so impossible. But I realized now that without quite thinking it through, I'd half imagined myself a place here in the tower. My little room upstairs, a cheerful rummaging through the laboratory and the library, tormenting Sarkin like an untidy ghost who left his books out of place and threw his great doors open, and who made him come to the spring festival and stay long enough to dance once or twice. I'd already known, without having to put it into words, that there wasn't a place for me in my mother's house anymore. But I knew I didn't want to spend my days roaming the world on a hut built on legs, like the story said of Yaga, or in the king's castle either. Kasha had wanted to be free, had dreamed of all the wide world open to her. I never had. But I couldn't belong here with him either. Sarkin had shut himself up in this tower. He'd taken us one after another. He'd used our connection, all so he wouldn't have to make one of his own. There was a reason he never came down into the valley. I didn't need him to tell me that he couldn't come to Olshanka and dance the circle without putting down his own roots, and he didn't want them. He'd kept himself apart for a century behind these stone walls full of old magic. Maybe he would let me come in, but he'd want to close the doors up again behind me. He'd done it before, after all. I'd made myself a rope of silk dresses and magic to get out. But I couldn't make him climb out the window if he didn't want to. I sat up away from him. His hand had slipped from my hair. I pushed apart the stifling bed curtains and slid out of the bed, taking one of the coverlets with me to wrap around me. I went to the window and pushed the shutters open and put my head and shoulders out into the open night air, wanting the breeze on my face. It didn't come. The air around the tower was still. Very still. I stopped, my hands braced on the stone still. It was the middle of the night, still pitch dark, most of the cooking fires gone out or banked for the night. I couldn't see anything down on the ground. I listened for the old stone voices of the walls we'd built and heard them murmuring, disturbed. I hurried back to the bed and shook Sarkan awake. "Something's wrong," I said. We scrambled into our clothes, Vanastalem spinning clean skirts up from my ankles and lacing a fresh bodice around my waist. He was cupping a soap bubble between his hands, a small version of one of his sentinels, giving it a message. "Vlad, rouse your men quickly. They're trying something under cover of night." He blew it out the window, and we ran. By the time we reached the library, torches and lanterns were being lit all through the trenches below. There were almost none in Marek's camp, though, except the ones held by the handful of guards, and one lamp shining inside his pavilion. "Yes," Sarkan said, "he is doing something." He turned to the table. He'd laid out half a dozen volumes of defensive magic. But I stayed at the window and stared down, frowning. I could feel the gathering of magic that had a flavor of Solia, but there was something else, something moving slow and deep. I still couldn't see anything, only a few guards and their rounds. Inside Marek's pavilion, a shape passed between the lantern and the tent wall and flung a shadow against the wall, a face in profile, a woman's head, hair piled high, and the sharp peaks of the circlet she wore. I jerked back from the window, panting, as if she'd seen me. Sarkan looked back at me, surprised. "She's here," I said. "The queen is here." There wasn't time to think what it meant. Marek's cannon roared out with gouts of orange fire, a horrible noise, and clods of dirt went flying as the first cannonballs smashed into the outer wall. I heard Solia give a great shout. A light blazed up all across Marek's camp. Men were thrusting coals into beds of straw and kindling that they had laid down in a line. A wall of flame leaped up to face my wall of stone, and Solia stood behind it. His white robe was stained with orange and red light, blowing out from his widespread arms. His face was clenched with strain, as if he were lifting something heavy. I couldn't hear the words over the roar of the fire, but he was speaking a spell. "Try to do something about that fire," Sarkan told me after one quick look down. He whirled back to his table and pulled out one of the dozen scrolls he'd prepared yesterday, a spell to blunt cannon fire. "But what?" I began. But he was already reading, the long, tangled syllables flowing like music, and I was out of time for questions. Outside, Solia bent his knees and heaved up his arms as if he were throwing a large ball. The whole wall of flame jumped into the air, and curved up over the wall, and into the trench, where the Baron's men crouched. Their screams and cries rose up with the crackling of the flames, and for a moment, I was frozen. The sky was wide, and too clear above. Stars from end to end. Not a cloud anywhere that I could wring rain from. I ran for the water jug in the corner in desperation. I thought, maybe if I could make one cloud grow into a storm, I could make a drop grow into a cloud. I poured water into the cup of my hand and whispered the rain spell over it, telling the drops they could be rain, they could be a storm, a blanketing deluge, until a pool shimmered solid quicksilver in my palm. I threw my handful of water out the window, and it did become rain. A hiccup of thunder and a single gush of water that went straight down into the trench, squashing the fire down in one place. The cannon kept roaring all the while. Sarkin was standing beside me at the window now, holding up the shield against them, but every thump struck against him like a blow. The orange fire lit his face from below, shone on his clenched teeth as he grunted with impact. I would have liked to speak to him, between the cannon rounds, to ask whether we were all right. I couldn't tell if we were doing well or if they were. But the fire in the trench was still burning. I kept throwing rain, but it was hard work making rain out of handfuls of water, and it got harder as I went along. The air around me went dry and parched, and my skin and hair winter crackly, as if I was stealing every bit of moisture around me, and the torrents only struck one part of the fire at the time. The Baron's men were doing their best to help, beating down the flames with cloaks soaked into the water that ran off. Then the two cannon roared together, but this time the flying iron balls glowed with blue and green fire, trailing them both like comets. Sarkin was flung back hard against the table, the edge slamming into his side. He staggered, coughing, the spell broken. The two balls tore through his shield and sank into the wall almost slowly, like pushing a knife into an unripe fruit. Around them, the rock seemed almost to melt away, glowing red around the edges. They vanished inside the wall, and then, with two muffled roars, they burst. A great cloud of earth went flying up. Chips of stone flung so hard, I heard them pattering against the walls of the tower itself, and a gap crumbled in right in the middle of the wall. Marek thrust his spear up into the air and roared, "Forward!" I couldn't understand why anyone would obey. Through that ragged opening, the fire still leaped and hissed, despite all my work, and men were screaming as they burned. But men did obey him. A torrent of soldiers came charging with spears held at waist level into the burning chaos of the trench. Sarkin pushed himself up from the table and came back to the window, wiping a trickle of blood from his nose and lip.
"He's decided to be profligate," he said grimly. "Each of those cannonballs was a decade in the forging. Polnia has fewer than 10 of them."
"I need more water," I said. And catching Sarkin's hand, I pulled him with me into the spell. I could feel him wanting to protest. He didn't have a spell prepared to match mine. But he muttered irritation under his breath and then gave me a simple cantrip, one of the early ones he tried to teach me, which was meant to fill up a glass of water from the well down below us. He'd been so annoyed when I either slopped water all over his table or barely brought up a trickle of drops. When he spoke the spell, water came rippling smoothly up to the very brim of my jug, and I sang my Wren spell to the whole jug and to the well below, all that deep, cold, sleeping water, and then I flung the whole jug out the window. For a moment, I couldn't see. A howl of wind blew rain sputtering into my face and eyes, the slap of a biting winter rain. I wiped my face with my hands. Down in the trench, a downpour had smothered the flames entirely, only small flickering pockets left, and armored men on both sides were sliding off their feet, falling in a sudden ankle-deep torrent. The gap in the wall was gashing mud, and with the fire gone, the Baron's men were crowding into the breach with their pikes, filling it up with bristling points and shoving back the men who'd been trying to come in. I sagged against the sill with relief. We'd stopped Solia's fire. We'd stopped Marek's advance. He'd already spent so much magic, more than he could afford, surely. And we'd still halted him. Surely now, he'd think better off.
Get ready, Sarkhan said.
Solia was casting another spell. He held his hands up into the air at an angle, all the fingers pointed, with his eyes looking straight along them. And silver lines lanced out from each finger and split into three. The arcing lines came down over the wall, each one landing on a different target. A man's eye, a chink in his armor at the throat, the elbow of his sword hand, the place directly over his heart. The lines didn't seem to do anything, as far as I could see. They just hung in the air, only barely visible in the dark. Then dozens of bows twanged at once. Marek had three lines of archers ranged up behind his foot soldiers. The arrows caught onto the silver lines and followed them straight home. I put out a hand, a useless gesture of protest. The arrows flew on. 30 men fell at once, cut down at a stroke, all of them defenders at the breach. Marek's soldiers shoved into the gap, spilling into the trench, and the rest of the army crowded in behind them. They began to try to push the Baron's soldiers back towards the first passageway. Every inch was hard fought. The Baron's men had put up a bristling thicket of spears and swords pointing out ahead of them and in the narrow space. Marek's men couldn't come at them without driving themselves onto the blades. But Sole sent another flight of arrows going over the walls towards the defenders. Sarkhan had turned away. He was shoving through his papers, looking for a spell to answer this new one, but he wasn't going to find it in time. I put my hand out again, but this time I tried the spell the dragon had used to bring Kasha in from the mountainside. Tual, Tual, Tual! I called to the strings, reaching, and they caught on my fingers, thrumming. I leaned out and threw them away, down towards the top of the wall. The arrows followed them and struck against stone, cluttering away in a heap. For a moment, I thought the silver light was just lingering on my hands, reflecting into my face. Then Sarkhan shouted a warning. A dozen new silver threads were pointing through the window, right at me, leading to my throat, my breast, my eyes. I only had one moment to grab up the ends in a bunch and blindly heave them away from me. Then the flight of arrows rushed buzzing in through the window and struck wherever I had thrown the lines, into the bookcase and the floor and the chair, sunk deep with the fledged ends quivering. I stared at them all, too startled to be afraid at first, not really understanding that I'd nearly been struck by a dozen arrows. Outside, the cannon roared. I'd already begun to be used to the noise. I flinched automatically, without looking, still half fascinated by how close the arrows were. But Sarkhan was suddenly heaving the entire table over, papers flying as it smashed to the floor, heavy enough to shake the chairs. He pulled me down behind it. The high whistling song of a cannonball was coming closer and closer. We had plenty of time to know what was going to happen, and not enough to do anything about it. I crouched under Sarkhan's arm, staring at the underside of the table. Chinks of light showing through the heavy wooden beams. Then the cannonball smashed through the window sill, the opened glass panes shattering into fragments with a crash. The ball itself rolled on until the stone wall stopped it with a heavy thud. Then it burst into pieces, and the creeping gray smoke came boiling out. Sarkhan clapped his hand over my mouth and nose. I held my breath. I recognized the stone spell. As the gray fog rolled gently towards us, Sarkhan made a hooking gesture to the ceiling, and one of the sentinel spears floated down to his hand. He pinched open its skin, made a hole, and with another wordless, peremptory gesture, waved the gray smoke into the sphere, until all of it was enclosed, churning like a cloud. My lungs were bursting before he finished. Wind was whistling noisily in through the gaping wall. Books scattered, torn pages riffling noisily. We pushed the table up against the open gap to help keep us from falling out of the window. Sarkhan picked up a piece of the hot cannonball with a cloth and held the sentinel next to it, like giving a scent to a hound. Menya kaja stona nalit, he told the sentinel, and gave it a push out into the night sky. It drifted away, the gray of it fading into just a scrap of fog. All that couldn't have taken more than a few minutes, no longer than I could hold my breath. But more of Marek's army had already crammed into the trench and pushed the Baron's men back towards the first tunnel. Sole had flung another arrow flight and opened more room for them. But more than that, Marek and his knights were riding just outside the wall behind them, spurring the men onward. I saw them using their horse whips and spears against their own soldiers, driving them through the breach. The ones in the front ranks were almost being pushed onto the defenders' blades horribly. Other soldiers were pressing up behind them, and little by little the Baron's soldiers were having to give way, a cork being forced out of a bottle. The trench was already littered with corpses, so many of them piled on one another. Marek's soldiers were even climbing up on top of the heaps to shoot arrows down at the Baron's men, as if they didn't care that they were standing on the bodies of their own dead comrades. From the second trench, the Baron's men began flinging Sarkhan's potion spheres over the wall. They landed in blue bursts, clouds that spread through the soldiers. The men caught inside the mist sank to their knees, or toppled over in heaps, faces dazed and sinking into slumber. But more soldiers came on after them, climbing over them, trampling them like ants. I felt a wild horror, looking at it, unreal. "We've misjudged the situation," Sarkhan said. "How can he do this?" I said, my voice shaking. It seemed as if Marek was so determined to win, he didn't care how expensive we made the walls. He'd pay anything, anything at all, and the soldiers would follow him to their deaths endlessly. He must be corrupted. I couldn't imagine anything else that would let him spend his own men's lives like this, like water. "No," Sarkhan said. "Marek's not fighting to win the tower. He's fighting to win the throne. If he loses to us here now, we'll have made him look weak before the Magnati. He's backed into a corner." I understood without wanting to. Marek really would spend everything he had. No price would be too high. All the men and magic he'd used already would only make it worse, like a man throwing good money after bad because he couldn't stand to lose what he'd already spent. We couldn't just hold him off. We'd have to fight him to the last man, and he had thousands of them left to pour into the battle. The cannon roared once more, as if to punctuate the terrible realization, and then they fell suddenly and blessedly silent. Sarkhan's floating sentinel had dropped down upon them and burst against the hot iron. The dozen men working on the cannon had frozen into statues. One man stood before the left cannon, with a rod thrust down the barrel. Others were bent over gripping ropes, dragging the right cannon back to its place. Still others held cannonballs or sacks in their hands. A monument to a battle that wasn't over. Marek at once ordered other men to come and get the statues clear of the cannon. They began dragging and shoving the statues away, toppling them into the dirt. I flinched when I saw one smashing the fingers off the statues to pry out the ropes. I wanted to shout down that the stone-turned men were still alive, but I didn't think Marek would care. The statues were heavy, and the work was slow, so we had a brief respite from the cannon fire. I steadied myself and turned to Sarkan. If we offered to surrender, I said, would he listen?
Certainly, Sarkan said. He'd put us both to death at once, and you might as well cut the children's throats yourself as hand them over, but he'd be delighted to listen.
He took a turn, thwarting the arrow spell. He pointed and spoke an incantation of misdirection, and another flight of silver-lead arrows struck against the outer wall. He shook out his hand and wrist, looking down. In the morning, he said finally, even if Marek is willing to destroy his entire army, men can't fight endlessly without a rest, and food and drink. If we can hold them until morning, he'll have to call them off for a little while. Then he might be willing to parley. If we can hold them until morning. Morning seemed far away. The pace of the battle ebbed for a little while. The Baron's men had retreated into the second trench entirely by now, filling the passageway in with corpses, so Marek's men couldn't keep coming. Marek rode his horse back and forth outside the walls, simmering and angry and impatient, watching while his men struggled to get the cannon firing again. Near him, Sole settled into a steady rhythm of throwing arrow flights into the second trench. It was an easier spell for him to throw than for us to deflect. The arrowheads were Alyosha's work. They wanted to find their way to flesh, and he was only showing them the way to go. Meanwhile, we were trying to twist them from their purpose, fighting not just his spell, but hers. The strength of her will, the hammer strokes that had beaten magic and determination into the iron, and even the arrow's natural flight. Pulling them aside was steady, grinding work, and meanwhile, Sole threw his silver guiding lines into the air with wide, easy sweeps of his arm, like a man sowing seeds. Sarkan and I had to take turns, each of us catching a flight at a time, each one an effort. We had no time or strength for any other working. There was a natural rhythm to the work, dragging away a flight of arrows, like hauling on a heavy fishing net, and then pausing to sip a little water and rest while Sarkan took his turn. Then I would go to the window again. But Sole broke the rhythm, again and again. He kept his flights spaced apart exactly the worst amount of time, just close enough that we couldn't sit down between them without having to spring up. And then every once in a while, he let a longer time go by, or threw the arrows at us instead, or sent two flights out in quick succession. He can't have an endless supply of them, I said, leaning against the wall, drained and aching. There were boys with the archers who were hunting for spent arrows, pulling them out of corpses and from against the walls where they'd struck and carrying them back to be shot again. No, Sarkan said, a little distant and remote, also turned inward by the steady drain of magic. But he's keeping the flight small. He'll likely have enough to last until morning. Sarkan went briefly out of the room after finishing his next turn, and brought back a sealed glass jar from the laboratory, full of cherries in syrup. He kept the big silver samovar on the table in the back corner of the library, which never ran out of tea. It had survived the ruin of the cannonball, although the delicate glass cup
had fallen over and smashed. He poured tea into two measuring bowls instead, and pushed the jar of cherries over to me. They were the deep, wine-red sour cherries, from the orchards outside Vyosna, halfway down the valley, preserved in sugar and spirits. I stirred in two heaping spoonfuls, and greedily licked the spoon clean. They tasted of home to me, and the valley's slow magic resting in them. He dipped only three of them out for himself, chary and measured, and he scraped the spoon on the edge of the jar, as though he was being careful, even now, not to take too much. I looked away and drank my own tea gladly, with both hands cupped around the bowl. It was a warm night, but I felt chilled through. "Lie down and get a little sleep," Sarkhan said. "He'll likely try a final push just before morning." The cannon had fired again at last, but without doing much harm. I guessed that all the men who really knew how to work them had been caught in the stone spell. Several of the bowls had fallen short, landing among Marek's own men, or went too far and flew past the tower entirely. The walls were holding. The Baron's men had covered the second trench with the pikes and spear hafts, and laid their blankets and tents on them, helping to hide themselves from the arrow flights. I felt thick, even after the tea, tired and dulled, like a knife that had been used to cut wood. I folded over the rug once to make a pallet, and it felt so very good to lie down on it. But sleep wouldn't come. The silver arrow flares lit the top of the window frame at long, stuttered intervals. The murmur of Sarkhan's voice, turning them aside, seemed far away. His face stood in shadow, the profile sharp outlined against the wall. The tower floor beneath my cheek and my ear trembled faintly with the fighting, like the distant, heavy step of an approaching giant. I shut my eyes and tried to think of nothing but my breath. Maybe I slept a moment. Then, I was sitting up with a jerk out of a dream of falling. Sarkhan was looking down through the broken window. The arrow flights had stopped. I pushed myself up and joined him. Knights and servants were milling around Marek's pavilion like stirred-up bees. The queen had come out of the tent. She was wearing armor, a mail shirt put over a simple white shift, and in one hand she carried a sword. Marek spurred over to her, bending down, speaking. She looked up towards him, with her face clear and hard as steel. "They'll give the children to the wood, as Vasily did me," she cried out to him, her voice ringing loud enough to hear. "Let them cut me limb from limb first." Marek hesitated, and then he swung down from the horse and called for his shield. He drew his own sword. The rest of his knights were climbing down beside him, and Solya was at his side. I looked at Sarkhan helplessly. I almost felt that Marek deserved to die after he'd driven so many of his men to death. But if that was what he really believed, if he thought we meant to do something dreadful to the children, how could he believe that? I asked. How could he convince himself that everything else was coincidence? Sarkhan said, already at his bookshelves. It's a lie that matches his desire. He lifted one volume off the shelf, in both his arms, a massive tome, nearly 3 feet tall. I reached out to help him, and jerked my hands away, involuntarily. It was bound in a kind of blackened leather that felt dreadful to the touch, sticky in a way that didn't want to rub off my fingers. "Yes, I know," he said, heaving it onto his reading chair. "It's a necromantic text. It's hideous. But I'd rather spend dead men twice than any more of the living." The spell was written out in long, old-fashioned script. I tried to help him read it, but I couldn't. I recoiled from even the first words. The root of that spell was death. It was death from beginning to end. I couldn't bear to even look at it.
Sarkan frowned at my distress and irritation. Are you being missish? He demanded.
No, you aren't. What the devil is the matter?
Never mind. Go and try to slow them down.
I sprang away, eager to get far from that book, and hurried to the window. I seized bits of broken stone and rubble from the floor, and tried the rain spell on them, the same way I'd used it on the water jug. Showers of dust and pebbles rained down on Marek's soldiers. They had to take cover, wrapping their hands over their heads, but the queen didn't so much as pose. She marched through the breach in the wall. She climbed over the corpses, the hem of her shift soaking up blood. Marek and his knights surged in front of her, holding their shields over their heads. I threw heavier rocks down at them, bigger chunks that grew into boulders. But even though a few of them staggered down to their knees, most of them stayed safe, tucked under their shields. They came to the passageway and began to seize the corpses and drag them out of the way. The baron's men stabbed at them with spears. Marek's knights caught blows on their shields and their armor. And didn't. Half a dozen of them fell, bodies in full gleaming armor, heaved back limp and dead. But they pressed on, forced an opening, and the queen stepped inside. I couldn't see the fighting inside the tunnel, but it was over quickly. Blood ran out of the passageway, black in the torchlight. And then the queen was stepping through the other side. She hurled down the head of a man she'd been gripping in her free hand, the neck sliced cleanly through. The defenders began backing away from her in fear. Marek and his knights spread out around her, hacking and killing, and his foot soldiers poured into the trench behind them. Solia lashed magic out in white, crackling streams. The baron's men began falling back quickly, stumbling over their own feet, away from the queen. I'd imagined Kasha with a sword, the same kind of horror. The queen lifted her sword again and again, stabbed and hacked, with brutal practicality, and none of their swords pierced her. Marek was shouting orders. The baron's men inside the last wall had climbed up onto the top of it and were trying to shoot at the queen from above. But the arrows couldn't break her skin. I turned and pulled one of the black, fletched arrows out of the bookcase where it had sunk in, one of the arrows Sole had fired at me, Alyosha's make. I took it to the window and stopped. My hands were shaking. I didn't see what else to do. None of them could stop her. But if I killed the queen, Marek would never listen to us, never. I might as well kill him now, too. If I killed her. I felt strange and sick at the thought. She was small and far away on the ground, a doll and not a person, her arm rising and falling.
A moment, Sarkan said. I backed away, reprieved and glad of it, although I had to cover my ears while he recited the long, shivering words of his spell. A wind breezed out through the window, brushing against my skin like a damp, oily palm, smelling of rot and iron. It kept blowing, steady and awful, and down in the trenches, the endless corpses stirred and slowly began to rise. They left their swords on the ground. They didn't need any weapons. They didn't try to hurt the soldiers, just reached out their empty hands and took hold of them, two and three to a man grasping. There were already more dead men than living ones in the trenches, and all the dead served the dragon spell. Marek's soldiers slashed and cut at them in a frenzy, but the dead didn't bleed. Their faces were sagging and blank, uninterested. Some of them plodded down the trench to grasp at the knights, at the queen's arms and legs, taking hold of her. But she flung them off, and the knights in their armor hacked them with their broadswords. The Baron's men were as horrified by the spell as Marek's. They were scrambling back from the dead.